I'm working on something else now. And she always was. Always something a bit different. Always something that had struck her fancy. She would be famous someday, Pearl was certain. Someday, her adored mother would be one of those artists like de Kooning or Warhol or O'Keeffe, whose name everyone knew. It was why part of her, at least, didn't mind the life they'd always lived. Their thrift store clothes, their salvaged beds and chairs, the shifting precariousness of it all. One day, everyone would see her mother's brilliance. To Moody, this kind of existence was all but unfathomable. Watching the Warrens live was like watching a magic trick, as miraculous as transforming an empty soda can into a silver pitcher, or pulling a steaming pie from a silk-top hat. No, he thought. It was like watching Robinson Crusoe conjure up a living out of nothingness. The more time he spent with Mia and Pearl, the more fascinated he became with them. Through his afternoons with Pearl, Moody slowly learned some of what their life on the road was like. They traveled lightly, 2 plates and 2 cups and a handful of mismatched silverware, a duffel of clothes each, and, of course, Mia's cameras. In the summer, they drove with the windows down, for the rabbit had no air conditioning. In the winter, they drove by night, the heat cranked up, and in the daytime would park in a sunny spot, sleeping in the snug greenhouse of the car, before starting again as the sun set. At night, Mia pushed the bags into the footwells and laid a folded army blanket across them and the back seat, forming a bed that could just hold them both. For privacy, they draped a sheet from the hatchback over the headrests of the front seats to make a little tent. At mealtimes, they stopped by the side of the road, feeding themselves from the paper bag of groceries behind the driver's seat. Bread and peanut butter, fruit, sometimes salami or a stick of pepperoni, if Mia found it on sale. Sometimes they drove for just a few days, sometimes for a week, until Mia found a spot that felt right, and they would stop. They would find an apartment for rent, usually a studio, sometimes in efficiency, whatever they could afford and wherever they could go month to month, for Mia did not like to be tied down. They would set up their new apartment as they had in Shaker, with cast-offs and thrift store finds made fresh, or at least tolerable. Mia would enroll Pearl in the local school and find work enough to support them, and then Mia would begin her next project, working, worrying the idea like a bone, for 3 months or 4 or 6 months, until she had a set of photographs to dispatch to Anita in New York City. She would set up a darkroom in the bathroom after Pearl had fallen asleep. After the first few moves, she'd gotten it down to a science. Trays for washing prints in the bathtub, a clothesline for drying strung from the shower rod, a rolled-up towel across the bottom of the door to block out any extra light. When she was finished, she stacked her trays, folded her enlarger into its case, hid her jugs of chemicals under the sink, and scrubbed the bathtub so that it was sparkling for Pearl's shower the next morning. She would crack the bathroom window and go to bed, and by the time Pearl woke, the sour smell of developer would be gone. Once Mia mailed her photographs, Pearl always knew they would pack up the car again, and the entire process would repeat. One town, one project, and then it was time to move on. This time, though, was to be different. "We're staying put," Pearl told him. And Moody felt suddenly giddily buoyant, like an overfilled balloon. "My mom promised. This time we're staying for good." Their itinerant, artistic lifestyle appealed to him. Moody was a romantic at heart. He made the honor roll every semester, but unburdened by practicalities, he had daydreams about leaving school, traveling the country a la Jack Kerouac, only writing songs instead of poems. Max Back supplied him with well-worn copies of On the Road and Dharma Bums, the poems of Frank O'Hara and Reina Maria Rilke and Pablo Neruda. And to his delight, he found in Pearl another poetic soul. She hadn't read as much as he had, of course, because they had moved so often, but she had spent most of her childhood in libraries, taking refuge among the shelves as a new girl bouncing from school to school. absorbing books as if they were air. And, in fact, she told him shyly, she wanted to be a poet. She copied her favorite poems into a beat-up spiral notebook that she kept with her at all times. "So they'll always be with me," she said. And when she finally allowed Moody to read some of them, he was speechless. He wanted to twine himself in the tiny curlicues of her handwriting. "Beautiful," he sighed. And Pearl's face lit up like a lantern. And the next day, Moody brought his guitar, taught her to play 3 chords, and bashfully sang one of his songs for her, which he'd never sung for anyone else. Pearl, he soon discovered, had a fantastic memory. She could remember passages after reading them through just once, could recall the dates of the Magna Carta and the names of the kings of England and every one of the presidents in order. Moody's grades came from meticulous studying and plenty of flashcards. But everything seemed to come easily to Pearl. She could glance at a math problem and intuit the answer while Moody dutifully worked line after line of algebra down the page. She could read an essay and put her finger, at once, on the most salient point or the biggest logical flaw. It was as if she had glanced at a pile of jigsaw puzzle pieces and saw the whole picture without even consulting the box. Pearl's mind, it became clear, was an extraordinary thing, and Moody could not help but admire how fast her brain worked, how effortlessly. It was a pure pleasure watching her click everything into place. The more time they spent together, the more Moody began to feel he was in two places at once. At any given moment, every moment he could arrange, in fact, he was there with Pearl, in the booth at the diner, in the fork of a tree, watching her big eyes drink in everything around them as if she were ferociously thirsty. He would crack dumb jokes and tell stories and dredge up bits of trivia, anything to make her smile. And at the same time, in his mind, he was roaming the city, searching desperately for the next place he could take her, the next wonder of suburban Cleveland he could display, because when he ran out of places to show her, he was sure she would disappear. Already he thought he saw her growing silent over their fries, prodding the last congealed lump of cheese on the plate. Already he was sure her eyes were drifting across the lake to the far shore. This was how Moody made a decision he would question for the rest of his life. Until now, he had said nothing about Pearl or her mother to his family, guarding their friendship like a dragon guards treasure, silently, greedily. Deep down, he had the feeling that somehow it would change everything, the way in fairy tales magic was spoiled if you shared the secret. If he had kept her to himself, perhaps the future might have been quite different. Pearl might never have met his mother or his father, or Lexi or Trip or Izzy, or if she had, they might have been people she only greeted but didn't know. She and her mother might have stayed in Shaker forever, as they'd planned. 11 months later, the Richardson house might still have been standing. But Moody did not think of himself as interesting enough to hold her attention in his own right. Had he been a different Richardson, it might have been different. His brother and sisters never worried whether other people would like them. Lexi had her golden smile and her easy laugh. Trip had his looks and his dimples. Why wouldn't people like them? Why would they ever even ask such a thing? For Izzy, it was even simpler. She didn't care what people thought of her. But Moody did not possess Lexi's warmth, Trip's roguish charm, Izzy's self-confidence. All he had to offer her, he felt, was what his family had to offer. His family itself. And it was this that led him to say, one afternoon in late July, "Come over. You can meet my family." When Pearl entered the Richardson's house for the first time, she paused with one foot on the threshold. "It was just a house," she told herself. "Moody lived here." But even that thought struck her as slightly surreal. From the sidewalk, Moody had nodded at it almost bashfully. "That's it," he'd said. And she had said, "You live here?" It wasn't the size. True, it was large, but so was every house on the street. And in just 3 weeks in Shaker, she'd seen even larger. No, it was the greenness of the lawn, the sharp lines of white mortar between the bricks, the rustle of the maple leaves in the gentle breeze, the very breeze itself. It was the soft smells of detergent and cooking and grass that mingled in the entryway, the one corner of the throw rug that flipped up like a cowlick, as if someone had mussed it and forgotten to smooth it out. It was as if instead of entering a house, she was entering the idea of a house, some archetype brought to life here before her, something she'd only heard about but never seen. She could hear signs of life in far-off rooms, the low mumble of a TV commercial, the beep of a microwave running down its count, but distantly, as if in a dream. "Come on in," Moody said, and she stepped inside. Later, it would seem to Pearl that the Richardsons must have arranged themselves into a tableau for her enjoyment, for surely they could not always exist in this state of domestic perfection. There was Mrs. Richardson in the kitchen making cookies, of all things, something her own mother never did, though if Pearl begged hard, she would sometimes buy a log of shrink-wrapped dough for them to slice into rounds. There was Mr. Richardson, a miniature, out on the wide green lawn, deftly shaking charcoal into a shining silver grill. There was Trip, lounging on the long wraparound sectional, impossibly handsome, one arm slung along the back as if waiting for some lucky girl to come and sit beside him. And there was Lexi, across from him in a pool of sunlight, turning her luminous eyes from the television toward Pearl as she came into the room, saying, "Well now, and who do we have here?" 4. The only member of the Richardson family that Pearl did not see much of in those giddy early days was Izzy. But at first, she didn't notice. How could she, when the other Richardsons greeted her with their long, enveloping arms? They dazzled her, these Richardsons, with their easy confidence, their clear sense of purpose, no matter the time of day. At Moody's invitation, she spent hours at their house, coming over just after breakfast, staying until dinner. Mornings, Mrs. Richardson sailed into the kitchen in high-heeled pumps, car keys, and stainless steel travel mug in hand, saying, "Pearl, so nice to see you again." Then she click-clacked down the back hall, and in a moment, the garage door rumbled open and her Lexus glided down the wide driveway, a golden pocket of coolness in the hot summer air. Mr. Richardson, in his jacket and tie, had left long before, but he loomed in the background, solid and impressive and important, like a mountain range on the horizon. When Pearl asked what his parents did all day, Moody had shrugged. "You know, they go to work." Work. When her mother said it, it reeked of drudgery, waiting tables, washing dishes, cleaning floors, but for the Richardsons, it seemed noble. They did important things. Every Thursday, the paperboy deposited a copy of the Sun Press on Mia and Pearl's doorstep. It was free to all residents, and when they unfolded it, they saw Mrs. Richardson's name on the front page under the headlines, "City Debates New Tax Levy. Residents React to President Clinton's Budget. Very Square Affair. Preparations Underway in Shaker Square." Tangible, black and white proof of her industriousness. "It's not really a big deal," Moody said. "The plain dealer is the real paper. The Sun Press is just local stuff. City council meetings and zoning boards and who won the science fair." But Pearl, eyeing the printed byline, "Elena Richardson," did not believe or care. They knew important people, the Richardsons. The mayor, the director of the Cleveland Clinic, the owner of the Indians. They had season tickets at Jacobs Field and the Gund. "The Cavs suck," Moody put it succinctly.
"Indians might win the pennant, though," countered Tripp.
Sometimes Mr. Richardson's cell phone, a cell phone, would ring, and he would extend the antenna as he stepped out into the hallway.
"Bill Richardson, he would answer, the simple statement of his name greeting enough. Even the younger Richardsons had it, this sureness in themselves. Sunday mornings, Pearl and Moody would be sitting in the kitchen when Tripp drifted in from a run, lounging against the island to pour a glass of juice, tall and tan and lean in gym shorts, utterly at ease, his sudden grin throwing her into disarray. Lexi perched at the counter, inelegant in sweatpants and a tee, hair clipped in an untidy bun, picking sesame seeds off a bagel. They did not care if Pearl saw them this way. They were so artlessly beautiful, even right out of bed. Where did this ease come from? How could they be so at home, so sure of themselves, even in pajamas? When Lexi ordered from a menu, she never said, "Could I have?" She said, "I'll have," confidently, as if she had only to say it to make it so. It unsettled Pearl, and it fascinated her. Lexi would slide down off her stool and walk across the kitchen with the elegance of a dancer, barefoot on the Italian tiles. Tripp swigged the last of his orange juice and headed for the stairs in the shower, and Pearl watched him, her nostrils quivering as she breathed in the scent of his wake, sweat and sun and heat. At the Richardson house were overstuffed sofas so deep you could sink into them as if into a bubble bath. Credenzas, heavy sleigh beds. Once you owned an enormous chair like this, Pearl thought, you would simply have to stay put. You would have to plant roots and make the place that held this chair your home. There were ottomans and framed photographs and curio cabinets full of souvenirs, their very frivolousness reassuring. You did not bring home a carved seashell from Key West or a miniature of the CN Tower or a finger-sized bottle of sand from Martha's Vineyard unless you intended to stay. Mrs. Richardson's family, in fact, had lived in Shaker for 3 generations now, almost, Pearl learned, since the city had been founded. To have such a deep taproot in a single place, to be immersed in it so thoroughly that it had steeped into every fiber of your being, she couldn't imagine it. Mrs. Richardson herself was another source of fascination. If she had been on a television screen, she would have felt as unreal as a Mrs. Brady or a Mrs. Keaton. But there she was, right in front of Pearl, always saying kind things. "What a pretty skirt, Pearl," she would say. "That color suits you. All honors classes? How smart you are." "Your hair looks so nice today." "Oh, don't be silly. Call me Elena. I insist." And then, when Pearl continued to call her Mrs. Richardson, she was secretly proud of Pearl's respectfulness. Pearl was sure of it. Mrs. Richardson was quick to hug her. Her, Pearl, a virtual stranger, simply because she was one of Moody's friends. Mia was affectionate, but never effusive. Pearl had never seen her mother embrace anyone other than her. And yet, there was Mrs. Richardson coming home for dinner, pecking each of her children atop the head, and not even pausing when she got to Pearl, dropping a kiss onto her hair without a moment of hesitation, as if she were just one more chick in the brood. Mia could not help but notice her daughter's infatuation with the Richardsons. Some days, Pearl spent the entire day at the Richardson house. She had been pleased at first, watching Moody and her lonely daughter, who had been uprooted so many times, who had never really been close to anyone. For so long, she could see now, she had made her daughter live by her whim, moving on any time she needed new ideas, any time she had felt stuck or uneasy. "That's over now," Mia had promised her as they drove toward Shaker. "From now on, we are staying put." She could see the similarities between these two lonely children, even more clearly than they could. The same sensitive personalities lurking inside both of them. The same bookish wisdom layered over a deep naivete. Moody would come by early each morning before Pearl had even finished breakfast, and on waking, Mia would draw the curtains to see Moody's bike sprawled on the front lawn and come into the kitchen to find him and Pearl at the table,
dregs of raisin bran in the mismatched bowls before them. They would be gone all day, Moody pushing his bike by the handlebars alongside them. Mia, rinsing the bowls in the sink, made a mental note to look for a bike for Pearl. Perhaps the bike shop on Lee Road had a used one. But as the weeks went on, it worried Mia a little, the influence the Richardsons seemed to have over Pearl. The way they seemed to have absorbed her into their lives, or vice versa. At dinner, Pearl talked about the Richardsons as if they were a TV show she was fanatical about. "Mrs. Richardson's going to interview Janet Reno when she comes to town next week," she might say one day. Or, "Lexi says her boyfriend Brian is going to be the first black president." Or, with a faint blush, "Tripp's going to be starting forward on the soccer team in the fall. He just found out." Mia nodded and mm-hmmed and wondered every evening if this was wise. If it was right for her daughter to fall under the spell of a family so entirely. Then she thought about the previous spring, when Pearl had gotten a cough so bad Mia had finally taken her to the hospital, where they learned it had turned into pneumonia. Sitting by her daughter's bedside in the dark, watching her sleep, waiting for the antibiotics the doctor had given her to take effect, Mia had allowed herself to imagine. If the worst had happened, what kind of life would Pearl have lived? Nomadic, isolated, lonely. "That's done with," she had told herself. And when Pearl had recovered, they'd ended up in Shaker Heights, where Mia had promised they would stay. So she said nothing. And the next day, another afternoon would pass, with Pearl over at the Richardsons again, becoming more bewitched. Pearl had started at new schools often enough, sometimes two or three times a year, to have lost her fear about it, but this time she was deeply apprehensive. To start a school knowing you'd be leaving was one thing. You didn't need to worry what other people thought of you, because soon you'd be gone. She had drifted through every grade like that, never bothering to get to know anyone. To start a school knowing you'd see these people all year, and next year, and the year after that, was quite different. But as it turned out, she and Moody shared nearly all their classes, from biology to honors English to health. The first 2 weeks of school, he guided her through the hallways with a confidence only a sophomore could have, telling her which water fountains were the coldest, where to sit in the cafeteria, which teachers would give you a tardy slip if they caught you in the halls after the late bell, and which would wave you on with an indulgent smile. She began to navigate the school with the help of the murals painted by students over the years. The exploding Hindenburg marked the science wing. Jim Morrison brooded by the auditorium balcony. A girl blowing pink bubbles led the way to the mysteriously named egress, a cavernous hallway that doubled as overflow lunchtime seating. A trompe-l'oeil row of lockers marked the hallway down to the social room, a lounge designated for the seniors, where there was a microwave for making popcorn during free periods and a Coke machine that cost only 50 cents instead of 75 like the ones in the cafeteria, and a chunky black cube of a jukebox left over from the 70s and now loaded with Sir Mix-a-Lot and Smashing Pumpkins and the Spice Girls. The year before, one student had painted himself and three friends peeking down Kilroy style in the domed ceiling near the main entrance. One of them was winking, and every time Pearl passed beneath the dome, she felt they were welcoming her in. After school, she went to the Richardsons' house and sprawled on the sectional in the family room with the older children and watched Jerry Springer. It was a little ritual the Richardson kids had developed over the past few years, one of the few times they agreed on anything. It had never been planned, and it was never discussed. But every afternoon, if Tripp didn't have practice and Lexi didn't have a meeting, they gathered in the family room and turned to Channel 3. To Moody, it was a fascinating psychological study. Every episode, another example of just how strange humanity could be. To Lexi, it was akin to anthropology. The stripper moms and polygamous wives and drug-dealing kids, a window into a world so far from hers it was like something out of Margaret Mead. And to Tripp,
The whole thing was pure comedy. A glorious slapstick spectacle, complete with bleeped-out tirades and plenty of chair-throwing. His favorite moments were when guests' wigs were pulled off. Izzy found the whole thing unspeakably idiotic and barricaded herself upstairs, practicing her violin. The only thing Izzy actually takes seriously, Lexi explained.
No, Trip countered. Izzy takes everything too seriously. That's her problem.
The ironic thing, Lexi said one afternoon, is that in 10 years, we're gonna see Izzy on Springer.
7, Trip said. 8, at most.
Jerry, get me out of jail! Or, my family wants to commit me, Lexi agreed. Moody shifted uncomfortably in his seat. Lexi and Trip treated Izzy as if she were a dog that might go rabid at any minute, but the two of them had always gotten along.
She's just a little impulsive, that's all, he said to Pearl.
A little impulsive? Lexi laughed.
You don't really know her yet, Pearl. You'll see.
And the stories began to pour out. Jerry Springer temporarily forgotten. Izzy, at 10, had been apprehended sneaking into the Humane Society in an attempt to free all the stray cats. They're like prisoners on death row, she'd said. At 11, her mother, convinced that Izzy was overly clumsy, had enrolled her in dance classes to improve her coordination. Her father insisted she try it for one term before she could quit. Every class, Izzy sat down on the floor and refused to move. For the recital, with the aid of a mirror and a Sharpie, Izzy had written, "Not Your Puppet," across her forehead and cheeks just before taking the stage, where she stood stock still while the others, disconcerted, danced around her.
"I thought Mom was going to die of embarrassment," Lexi said. "And then last year, Mom thought she wore too much black and bought her all these cute dresses. And Izzy just rolled them up in a grocery bag and took the bus downtown and gave them to some person on the street. Mom grounded her for a month."
"She's not crazy," Moody protested. "She just doesn't think."
Lexi snorted, and Trip hit unmute on the remote, and Jerry Springer roared to life again. The sectional seated 8. But even with only 3 Richardson children, there was always a fair amount of jockeying to get the spots with the best view. Now, with the addition of Pearl, there were even more complicated maneuverings. Whenever she could manage it, Pearl would drop, unobtrusively, nonchalantly, she hoped, into the seat next to Trip. All her life, her crushes had been from afar. She'd never had the courage to speak to any of the boys who caught her fancy. But now that they'd settled in Shaker Heights for good, now that Trip was here, in this house, sitting on the very same couch, well, it was perfectly natural, she told herself, that she might sit next to him now and then. No one could read into that, surely, least of all Trip. Moody, meanwhile, felt he deserved the seat beside Pearl. He was the one who had introduced her to the fold, and of all the Richardsons, he felt his claim, as the one who'd known her longest, was paramount. The end result was that Pearl would settle beside Trip. Moody would plop down beside her, sandwiching her between them. Lexi would stretch out on the corner, smirking at the three of them, and turn on the television, and all 4 of them turn their attention to the screen while remaining keenly aware of everything happening in the room. The Richardson children, Pearl soon learned, had their most heated discussions about Jerry Springer. "Thank God we live in Shaker," Lexi said one day during a provocative episode entitled, "Stop Bringing White Girls Home to Dinner." "I mean, we're lucky. No one sees race here."
"Everyone sees race, Lex," said Moody. "The only difference is who pretends not to."
"Look at me and Ryan," said Lexi. "We've been together since junior year, and no one gives a crap that I'm white and he's black."
"You don't think his parents would rather he was dating somebody black?" said Moody.
"I honestly don't think they care." Lexi popped the tab on another Diet Coke.
Skin color doesn't say anything about who you are.
Shh, said Trip. It's back.
It was during one of those afternoons, during I'm having your husband's baby, that Lexi suddenly turned to Pearl and asked, Do you ever think about trying to find your father? Pearl gave her a calculated blank stare, but Lexi continued anyway.
I mean, like where he is. Don't you ever want to meet him?
Pearl turned her eyes to the TV screen, where burly security guards were wrestling an orange-haired woman built like a Barca lounger back into her seat.
I'd have to start by finding out who he is, she said. And I mean, look at how well this is going. Why wouldn't I want to?
Sarcasm didn't come naturally to her, and even to herself she sounded more plaintive than ironic.
He could be anybody, Lexi mused. An old boyfriend?
Maybe he split when your mom got pregnant. Or maybe he got killed in an accident before you were born. She tapped one finger on her lip, brainstorming possibilities.
He could have left her for another woman.
Or, she sat up titillated, maybe he raped her, and she got pregnant and kept the baby.
Lexi,
Tripp said suddenly. He slid across the sofa and slung an arm over Pearl's shoulders.
Shut the fuck up!
For Tripp to pay attention to a conversation that wasn't about sports, let alone tune in on someone else's feelings, was nothing short of unusual, and they all knew it. Lexi rolled her eyes.
I was just kidding, she said.
Pearl knows that. Don't you, Pearl?
Sure, Pearl said.
She forced herself to smile.
Duh.
She felt a sudden rush of dampness beneath her arms, her heart pounding, and she wasn't sure if it was Tripp's arm around her shoulders, or Lexi's comments, or both. Above them, somewhere overhead, Izzy practiced Lalo on her violin. On the screen, two women leapt from their seats again and began to claw at each other's hair. But Lexi's comment rankled. It was nothing Pearl hadn't thought about herself over the years, but hearing it spoken aloud from someone else's mouth made it feel more urgent. She had wondered these things now and again, but when she'd asked as a child, her mother had given her flippant answers.
Oh, I found you in the bargain bin at the Goodwill, Mia had said once.
Another time?
I picked you from a cabbage patch, didn't you know?
As a teen, she'd finally stopped asking. This afternoon, the question still churning in her mind, she got home and found her mother in the living room, applying paint to a photograph of a stripped-down bicycle.
Mom, she began,
then found she could not repeat Lexi's blunt words. Instead, she asked the question that ran below all the other questions like a deep underground river.
Was I wanted?
Wanted where? With one careful lick of the brush, Mia supplied a Prussian blue tire in the empty fork of the bike.
Here. I mean, did you want me? When I was a baby?
Mia said nothing for such a long time that Pearl wasn't sure if she'd heard. But after a long pause, Mia turned around, paintbrush in hand, and to Pearl's amazement, her mother's eyes were wet. Could her mother be crying? Her unflappable, redoubtable, indomitable mother, whom she had never seen cry, not when the rabbit had broken down by the side of the road and a man in a blue pickup had stopped as if to help, taken Mia's purse and driven away. Not when she dropped a heavy bedstead, salvaged from the side of the road, on her baby toe, smashing it so hard the nail eventually turned a deep eggplant and fell away. But there it was, an unfamiliar shimmer over her mother's eyes, as if she were looking into rippled water.
Were you wanted? Mia said.
Oh, yes. You were wanted. Very, very much. She set the paintbrush down on the tray and walked rapidly out of the room without looking at her daughter again, leaving Pearl to contemplate the half-finished bicycle, the question she'd asked, the puddle of paint,
slowly forming a skin over the bristles of the brush.
5.
As if the Jerry Springer episode had awakened her to Pearl's presence, Lexi began to take a new interest in her little brother's friend. "Little orphan Pearl," she said to Serena Wong one evening on the phone.
"She's so quiet," Lexi marveled. "Like she's afraid to speak. And when you look at her, she turns bright red, red, like a tomato. A literal tomato."
"She's super shy," Serena said. She'd met Pearl a few times at the Richardsons, but hadn't yet heard her say a word.
"She probably just doesn't know how to make friends."
"It's more than that," Lexi mused. "It's like she's trying not to be seen, like she wants to hide in plain sight."
Pearl, so timid and quiet, so unsure of herself, fascinated Lexi. And being Lexi, she began with the surface.
"She's cute," she said to Serena.
"She'd look so adorable out of those baggy t-shirts." This is how, one afternoon, Pearl came home with a bag full of new clothes. Not new, precisely, as Mia found when she put them to wash. Patched jeans from the 70s with a ribbon down the side. A flowered cotton blouse just as old. A cream-colored t-shirt with Neil Young's face on the front.
"Lexi and I went to the thrift store," Pearl explained when Mia came back upstairs from the laundry room. "She wanted to go shopping."
In fact, Lexi had first taken Pearl to the mall. It was natural, she had felt, that Pearl would turn to her for advice. Lexi was used to people wanting her opinion, to the point where she often assumed they did and just hadn't quite said so. And Pearl was a little sweetheart, that was clear. Those big, dark eyes, somehow made to look even bigger and darker with no makeup at all. That long, dark, frizzy hair that, when turned loose from its braid, as she one afternoon convinced Pearl to do, looked as if it might swallow her up. The way she looked at everything in their house, everything, everywhere, really, as if she'd never seen it before. The second time Pearl had come over, Moody had left her in the sunroom and gone to get drinks, and Pearl, instead of sitting down, had turned in a slow circle, as if she were in Oz instead of the Richardson's house. Lexi, who had been coming down the hall with the latest Cosmo and a Diet Coke in hand, had stopped outside the doorway, just out of view, and watched her. Then Pearl had reached out one timid finger and traced a vine in the wallpaper. And Lexi had felt a warm gush of pity for her. The sad little mouse. Just then, Moody came out of the kitchen with two cans of Werner's.
"Didn't know you were here," he'd said. "We were going to watch a movie."
"I don't mind," Lexi had said, and she found she didn't. She settled herself into the big chair in the corner, one eye on Pearl, who sat down at last and popped the tab of her soda. Moody pushed a tape into the VCR, and Lexi flicked open her magazine. Something occurred to her, a good deed she might do.
"Hey, Pearl, you can have this when I'm done," she said, and felt the fuzzy internal glow of teenage generosity.
So that afternoon in early October, she decided to take Pearl on a shopping trip.
"Come on, Pearl," she said. "We're going to the mall."
When Lexi said the mall, she did not for a moment consider Randall Park Mall, off busy Warrensville Road, past a tire place, a rent-to-own store, and an all-night daycare. Randall Dark Mall, some kids called it. Living in Shaker, she thought only of where she did all her shopping. Beechwood Place, a manicured little mall set off from the street on its own little oval, anchored by a Dillard's and a Saks and a new Nordstrom. She had never heard the term Bleach White Place, and would have been horrified if she had. But despite a trip to the Gap and Express and the Body Shop, Pearl bought nothing but a pretzel and a pot of kiwi-flavored lip balm.
"Didn't you see anything you liked?" Lexi asked.
Pearl, who had only $17 and knew Lexi's weekly allowance was 20, paused.
"It's all the same stuff, you know," she said at last.
She waved a hand in the general direction of the Chick-fil-A and the mall beyond it.
Everyone shows up at school looking like clones.
She shrugged and glanced at Lexi out of the corner of her eye, wondering if she sounded convincing.
I just like to shop at places that are a little different, where I can get something no one else will have.
Pearl stopped, eyeing the blue and white Gap bag dangling from Lexi's arm by its drawstrings, wondering suddenly if she would be offended. But Lexi was seldom, if ever, offended. Subtle implications and subtext tended to bounce off the fine mesh of her brain.
She tipped her head to one side.
"Like where?" she asked. So Pearl had directed Lexi down Northfield Road, past the racetrack, to the thrift store, where women on break from the Taco Bell down the street or getting ready for the night shift browsed alongside them. She had been in dozens of thrift stores in dozens of cities in her life, and somehow every single one had the exact same smell, dusty and sweet. And she had always been sure that the other kids could smell it on her clothes, even after double washings, as if the scent had soaked right into her skin. This one, where she and her mother had rummaged through the bins for old sheets to use as curtains, was no different. But now, hearing Lexi's delighted squeal, she saw the store through new eyes. A place where you could find cocktail dresses from the 60s for homecoming, surgical scrubs for lounging on sleepy days, a wide assortment of old concert tees, and if you were lucky, Vels. Real Vel bottoms. Not the back-again retro ones from the Delia's catalog, but the actual thing, with wide flares, the denim tissue-thin at the knees from decades of wear.
Vintage, Lexi sighed, and set upon the rack with reverence.
Instead of the blouses and hippie skirts Mia always selected for her, Pearl found herself with an armful of quirky T-shirts, a skirt made from an old pair of Levi's, a navy zip-up hoodie. She showed Lexi how to read the price tags. On Tuesdays, anything with a green tag was half off. On Wednesdays, it was yellow. And when Lexi found a pair of jeans that fit, Pearl expertly pried off the orange price tag and replaced it with a green one from an ugly 80s polyester blazer. Under Pearl's guidance, the jeans came to $4, Pearl's entire bag to $13.75. And Lexi was so pleased that she pulled into the Wendy's drive-thru and treated them to a frosty apiece.
"Those jeans fit you like they were made for you," Pearl told her in return. "You were destined to have them."
Lexi let a spoonful of chocolate melt against her tongue.
"You know what?" she said, half closing her eyes, as if to put Pearl in sharper focus. "That skirt would go great with a striped button down. I've got an old one you can have."
When they got back to her house, she pulled a half dozen shirts from the closet.
"See?"
she said, smoothing the collar around Pearl's neck, carefully buttoning a single button between her breasts for the minimum of modesty, the way all the senior girls were wearing them that year. She swiveled Pearl toward the mirror and nodded approvingly.
"You can take those," she said. "They look cute on you. I've got too many clothes as it is."
Pearl had bundled the shirts into her bag. If her mother noticed, she decided, she would say she got them at the thrift store, with everything else. She wasn't sure why, but she felt sure her mother would not approve of her taking Lexi's old things, even if Lexi didn't want them. Mia, putting the clothes to wash, noticed that the shirts smelled of Tide and perfume rather than dust, that they were crisp, as if they'd been ironed. But she said nothing. And the following evening, all of Pearl's new clothes appeared in a neat pile at the foot of her bed, and Pearl breathed a sigh of relief. A few days later, in the Richardson's kitchen and clad in one of Lexi's shirts, she noticed Tripp looking at her again and again out of the corner of his eye and adjusted her collar with a smug little smile. Tripp himself was not even aware of why he was glancing at her, but he could not help noticing the little hourglass of skin her shirt revealed. The bare triangle framed by her collarbones. The bare triangle of midriff, with a delicate indent of her navel. The intermittent flash of navy blue bra above and below that single fastened button.
"You look nice today," he said, as if he were noticing her for the first time, and Pearl turned a deep pink, right down to the roots of her hair.
He seemed embarrassed, too, as if he had just revealed a fondness for a very uncool TV show.
Moody could not let this pass.
"She always looks nice," he said.
"Shut up, Trip."
As usual, however, Trip did not notice his brother's irritation.
"I mean, extra nice," he said. "That shirt suits you. Brings out the color of your eyes."
"It's Lexi's," Pearl blurted out, and Trip grinned.
"Looks better on you," he said,
almost shyly, and headed outside. The next day, Moody raided his savings and presented Pearl with a notebook, a slim, black moleskin held shut with an elastic garter.
"Hemingway used this exact same kind," he told her, and Pearl thanked him and zipped it into her book bag.
She would copy her poems into it, he thought, instead of that ratty old spiral notebook, and it gave him some comfort, when she smiled at Trip or blushed at his compliments, to know that he'd given her the notebook that was holding her favorite words and thoughts. The following week, Mrs. Richardson decided to have the carpet steamed, and all the children were told to stay out of the house until dinner time.
"If I see one boot print, Izzy, or one cleat mark, Trip, on those carpets, you will lose your allowance for a year. Understood?"
Trip had an away soccer game, and Izzy had a violin lesson. But Lexi, it happened, had nothing to do. Serena Wong had cross-country practice, and all her other friends were occupied one way or another. After 10th period, she tracked Pearl down at her locker.
"What you up to?" Lexi asked, popping a white tablet of gum into Pearl's hand.
"Nothing. Let's go to your place." In all her previous years, Pearl had been reluctant to invite friends to her home. Their apartments had always been crowded and cluttered, often in run-down sections of town, and odds were high that on any given day, Mia might be working on one of her projects, which, to an outsider's eye, meant doing something odd and inexplicable. But Lexi appearing at her elbow, Lexi asking to come over to her house, Lexi asking to spend time with her, she felt like Cinderella looking up to see the prince's outstretched hand.
"Sure," she said.
To Pearl's delight and Moody's great irritation, the three of them climbed into Lexi's Explorer and they headed down Parkland Drive toward the house on Winslow, TLC blasting from the rolled-down windows. When they pulled up in front of the house, Mia, who was outside watering the azaleas, fought the sudden but overpowering urge to drop the hose and run inside and lock the door behind her. Just as Pearl had never asked friends over, Mia never invited outsiders either.
"Don't be ridiculous," she told herself. "This is what you wanted, wasn't it? For Pearl to have friends?" By the time the doors of the Explorer opened and the three teenagers piled out, she had turned off the water and greeted them with a smile. As Mia made a batch of popcorn, Pearl's favorite and the only snack in the cupboard, she wondered if the conversation would be hobbled by her presence. Perhaps they would sit there in awkward silence, and Lexi would never want to come over again. But by the time the first kernels pinged against the pot lid, the three teens had already discussed Anthony Brecker's new car, an old VW bug painted purple, how Meg Kaufman had come to school drunk the week before, how much better Anna Lamont looked now that she was straightening her hair, and whether the Indians should change their logo.
"Chief Wahoo," Lexi said, "is so blatantly racist." Only when the subject of college applications came up did the conversation stall. Mia, shaking the pot so the popcorn wouldn't scorch, heard Lexi groan in a thunk that might have been her forehead hitting the table. College applications had been increasingly on Lexi's mind. Shaker took college seriously. The district had a 99% graduation rate, and virtually all the kids went on to college of some kind. Everyone Lexi knew was applying early, and as a result, all anyone could talk about in the social room was who was applying where. Serena Wong was applying to Harvard. Brian, Lexi said, had his heart set on Princeton.
"Like Cliff and Claire would let me go anywhere else," he'd said. His parents were really named John and Deborah Avery, but his father was a doctor and his mother was a lawyer, and, truth be told, they did exude a certain Cosby-ish vibe. His father sweatered and affable, and his mother wittily competent and no-nonsense. They'd met at Princeton as undergraduates, and Brian had pictures of himself as a baby in a Princeton onesie. For Lexi, the precedent was not quite so clear. Her mother had grown up in Shaker and had never gone far, just down to Denison for her undergrad before boomeranging back. Her father had come from a small town in Indiana and, once he'd met her mother at college, simply stayed, moving back with her to her hometown, finishing a JD at Case Western, working his way up from a junior associate to partner at one of the biggest firms in the city. But Lexi, like most of her classmates, had no desire to stay anywhere near Cleveland. It huddled on the edge of a dead, dirty lake, fed by a river best known for burning. It was built on a river whose very name meant sadness. Chagrin. Which then gave its name to everything. Pockets of agony scattered throughout the city, buried like veins of dismay. Chagrin Falls. Chagrin Boulevard. Chagrin Reservation. Chagrin Real Estate, Chagrin Auto Body, Chagrin reproducing and proliferating as if they would ever run short. The mistake on the lake, people called it sometimes. And to Lexi, as to her siblings and friends, Cleveland was something to be escaped. As the deadline for early applications approached, Lexi had decided to apply early to Yale. It had a good drama program, and Lexi had been the lead in the musical last year, even though she'd only been a junior. Despite her air of frivolity, she was near the top of her class. Officially, Shaker did not rank its students to reduce competitive feelings, but she knew she was somewhere in the top 20. She was taking 4 AP classes and served as secretary of the French club. "Don't let the shallowness fool you," Moody had told Pearl. "You know why she watches TV all afternoon? Because she can finish her homework in half an hour before bed. Like that." He snapped his fingers. Lexi's got a good brain. She just doesn't always use it in real life. Yale seemed a stretch, but a distinctly possible one, her guidance counselor had said. Plus, Mrs. Lieberman had added, they know kids from Shaker always go on to do well. They'll give you an edge. Lexi and Brian had been together since junior year, and she liked the idea of being just a train ride away. "We can visit each other all the time," Lexi pointed out to him as she printed the Yale early application. "And we can even meet up in New York." It was this last that finally swayed her. New York, which had exuded a glamorous pull on her imagination ever since she'd read Eloise as a child. She didn't want to go to school in New York. Her guidance counselor had floated the idea of Columbia, but Lexi had heard the area was sketchy. Still, she liked the idea of being able to jaunt in for a day, a morning at the Met looking at art, maybe a splurge at Macy's or even a weekend away with Brian, and then zip away from the crowds and the grime and the noise. Before any of that could happen, though, she had to write her essay. A good essay, Mrs. Lieberman had insisted, was what she needed to set herself apart from the pack. "Listen to this dumbass question," she groaned that afternoon in Pearl's kitchen, fishing the printed-out application from her bag. "Rewrite a famous story from a different perspective. For example, retell the Wizard of Oz from the point of view of the Wicked Witch." "This is a college app, not creative writing. I'm taking AP English. At least ask me to write a real essay." "How about a fairy tale?" Moody suggested. He looked up from his notebook and the open algebra textbook before him. "Cinderella from the point of view of the stepsisters. Maybe they weren't so wicked after all. Maybe she was actually a bitch to them." "Little Red Riding Hood is told by the wolf," Pearl suggested. "Or Rumpelstiltskin," Lexi mused. "I mean, that Miller's daughter cheated him. He did all that spinning for her, and she said she'd give him her baby, and then she reneged on their deal. Maybe she's the villain here." With one maroon fingernail, she tapped the top of the Diet Coke she'd bought just after school, then popped the tab. "I mean, she shouldn't have agreed to give up her baby in the first place if she don't want to." "Well," Mia put in suddenly, She turned around, the bowl of popcorn in her hands, and all three of them jumped, as if a piece of furniture had begun to speak. Maybe she didn't know what she was giving up until afterward. Maybe once she saw the baby, she changed her mind. She set the bowl down in the center of the table. "Don't be too quick to judge, Lexi."
Lexi looked chastened for an instant, then rolled her eyes.
Moody darted a look at Pearl. "See how shallow?" But Pearl didn't notice. After Mia had gone back into the living room, embarrassed at her outburst, she turned to Lexi.
"I could help you," she said,
quietly enough that she thought Mia could not hear. Then a moment later, because this did not seem like enough, "I'm good at stories. I could even write it for you."
"Really?" Lexi beamed. "Oh my God, Pearl, I'll owe you forever."
She threw her arms around Pearl. Across the table, Moody gave up on his homework and slammed his math book shut. And in the living room, Mia jammed her paintbrush into a jar of water, lips pursed, paint scrubbing from the bristles in a dirt-colored swirl.
6.
Pearl, true to her word, handed Lexi a typed-up essay the next week, the story of the frog prince from the point of view of the frog. Neither Mia, who did not want to admit she'd been eavesdropping, nor Moody, who did not want to be labeled a goody-two-shoes, said a word about it. But both were growing increasingly uneasy. When Moody arrived in the morning so they could walk to school together, Pearl would emerge from her room wearing one of Lexi's button-downs, or a spaghetti strap tank, or dark red lipstick.
"Lexi gave it to me," she explained, half to her mother and half to Moody, both of whom were staring at her in dismay.
"She said it was too dark for her, but that it looked good on me, because my hair's darker." Under the smudge of lipstick, her lips looked like a bruise, tender and raw.
"Wash that off," Mia said, for the first time ever.
But the next morning, Pearl came out wearing one of Lexi's chokers, which looked like a gash of black lace around her neck.
"See you at dinner," she said. "Lexi and I are going shopping after school."
By late October, as one by one applications were sent in, a spirit of celebration set in among the seniors. Lexi's application had been submitted, and she was in a benevolent mood. Her essay, thanks to Pearl, was good. Her SAT scores were strong, her GPA was over 4.0 thanks to her AP classes, and she could already picture herself on Yale's campus. She felt she should reward Pearl in some way for her assistance, and after some thought, came up with the perfect idea. Something she was sure Pearl would love, but would never get invited to on her own.
"Stacy Perry's having a party this weekend. Wanna come?"
Pearl hesitated. She had heard about Stacy Perry's parties, and the chance to go to one was tantalizing.
"I don't know if my mom will let me."
"Come on, Pearl," Tripp said, leaning over the arm of the couch. "I'm going. I'm going to need someone to dance with."
After that, Pearl needed no further persuasion. At Shaker Heights High School, Stacy Perry's parties were things of legend. Mr. and Mrs. Perry had a big house and took frequent trips, and Stacy took full advantage. With the tension of early applications released and weeks yet until finals, the seniors were ready for fun. All week, the Halloween party was the hot topic of discussion, who was going and who wasn't. Moody and Izzy, of course, had not been invited. They knew Stacy Perry only by reputation, and the invite list had mostly been seniors. Pearl, despite Lexi's involvement, still knew almost no one besides the Richardsons, and Moody was often the only person she spoke with during school. Lexi and Serena Wong, though, had both been invited by Stacy herself, and thus had dispensation to bring a guest, even a sophomore that no one really knew.
"I thought we were going to rent Carrie," Moody grumbled. "You said you'd never seen it."
"Next weekend," Pearl promised. "That's actually Halloween anyway, unless you want to go trick-or-treating."
"We're too old," Moody said.
Shaker Heights, as with everything, had regulations about trick-or-treating. Sirens wailed at 6 and 8 to mark the start and end, and although there were no official age restrictions, people tended to look askance at teens who showed up at their doors. The last time he had gone trick-or-treating, he'd been 11, and he'd gone as an M&M. For Stacy's party, though, a costume was de rigueur. Brian was not going. He had put off his early application to Princeton.